CPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programs on WILL are made possible by Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design in downtown Champaign, featuring Opals from the Outback, a series of gemstone roundtables to benefit WILL on October 7th, 8th, and 9th. More information is available at 352-2415.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm David Teal, your guest host for this hour. Celeste Quinn is taking some time off. Public relations have long been a part of presidential politics. In 1917, Woodrow Wilson founded the Committee on Public Information to influence support for U.S. involvement in World War I. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the first president to study public opinion polling, and he made direct appeals to citizens through his fireside chats. During the Reagan and Clinton presidencies, public relations tactics became more sophisticated, employing visual imagery and verbal sidestepping to shape opinion and avoid controversy. According to the authors of a new book, the current administration has set a new standard for political spin that may become the norm for future White Houses. Ben Fritz, Brian Kiefer, and Brendan Nyhan are the authors of the website SpinSanity.com, which they describe as a nonpartisan watchdog dedicated to unspinning misleading claims from politicians, pundits, and the press. The SpinSanity crew have detailed alleged distortions by John Kerry, Michael Moore, and many others, but have also strongly criticized the Bush administration in their recent book, All the President's Spin, George W. Bush, the Media, and the Truth, available now in paperback from Simon & Schuster. Our guest today is Ben Fritz, who also reports for the entertainment trade paper Variety and edits the satirical website Dateline Hollywood. He talks with us today about the political spin cycle and its impact on the current election campaign. Good afternoon, Mr. Fritz, and welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure and a very interesting book. I'm curious, I've been looking at SpinSanity.com for the last week or so preparing for this, and interested to find out how you got involved as one of the founders of an anti-spin website.
Sure. Well, you know, we didn't do it to get girls, believe it or not. the other two guys and I, we knew each other. Brendan and I went to college together, and Brendan and Brian went to high school together. And we started it, a year or two after we all graduated college. And I think we were all kind of had been interested in politics and media, but had sort of initial jobs or internships in the field, and quickly grew frustrated with kind of all the spinning you have to do in order to get ahead. It wasn't something we wanted to do. But we were doing other things, but wanted to stay involved in politics somehow. And after the 2000 election and the recount, we just really felt that like political dishonesty and the spin that flew back and forth without any fact-checking in the media is one of the biggest problems, in our system that's really being unaddressed. We thought that was something we could sort of, challenge on the web, and we started doing it, and it proved really popular. It seemed like something people are really interested in.
Now, you talk about dishonesty there, and I mean, in your book, you had a kind of a precise definition of what you believe constitutes dishonesty in the political process. Could you talk about that?
Sure. We wanted to be careful to separate what we think is dishonesty and isn't. I think one thing people often say is a politician lying is when they promise to do something and then they don't. And we don't think that's what qualifies. Because, situations can often change, and it's always sometimes it's hard to do what you want to do, and just because you can't do it doesn't mean you didn't mean to. That's the kind of thing where you think you're getting in somebody's head and dealing with their intentions, and that's not what we deal with. We deal with when a politician or pundit either definitely does know or, with any reason, reasonably should know something to be true, and they say or imply, the opposite. They say or imply something's false, and they either know or should know better.
Now, you have said in the book that you really don't get into the ideological discussions on this site, and I haven't found that to be true. So, I found that you haven't. that is indeed true from what I have read. So, I mean, you are really just interested, at least on the site, in terms of how these things are related.
Right. In the site and the book, we're just talking about dishonesty, and we go after both sides, which doesn't mean we do it 50-50. We just go after whoever we see spinning the most. I mean, because you know, we think that's important so that our critique of dishonesty can be taken seriously, so that you don't just think we're out to get one side or the other. And also, you know, I think there are already plenty of people out there commenting on, you know, why liberals are right or why conservatives are right. And, you know, I don't think we really need more of that. I think this is more of an unfulfilled need.
Yeah, and as you say, you're a nonpartisan, and right now I saw the top story on the front page today of SpinSanity.com is carry and move on, mislead on assault weapons. So there's that. But for this book, you've chosen to focus on the Bush administration, and I guess my question to you is what prompted you to do that?
Sure. There are a few reasons. One is we wanted to be able to sort of have a larger story to tell. We didn't just want our book to be kind of a collection of columns or a collection of short hits on everybody, because we already do that on our website. The great thing about a book is it lets us take a much bigger picture view, sort of help tie things together, which we can't do on the site. And if we, you know, and Bush would be the perfect, you know, topic for several reasons. One is simply that he is the president, he's a leader of the country, and he has been for the past, you know, almost 4 years. So he is in a position to just that he's done a lot of stuff, which in our current political system means a lot of spinning. So he makes a great case study just because he's in charge. But on top of that, I think Bush has proven willing and able to really push spin further than anybody before him. And he's done a lot of interesting and disturbing new things, which I think are really worthy of critique. And I don't think, there have obviously been a lot of anti-Bush books, but nobody's done this in a nonpartisan way, talk about his methods of deception. I think that was really a gaping hole that we thought needed to be addressed.
I want to take a moment here to let our listeners know about the phone numbers to call. We'll be taking questions during this hour. The number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the area, anywhere in the U.S., you can use our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. Now, political spin isn't really anything new, but what do you feel has changed in the last, say, 25 years or so?
Sure. What's changed is the use of really modern PR tactics that are designed to mislead without outright lying. And really take advantage of the modern media, meaning television and even more recently cable news and the internet. And things move so frequently, there's so many stories that you really need a super sophisticated spin operation to deal with it that takes advantage of visual images and sound bites, and you know, because that's the way that we get a lot of our news now, is through sound bites and the things we see on television. And that's what Reagan and Clinton really pushed forward. Reagan certainly pushed ahead on the use of visual imagery and having backdrops and settings to kind of reinforce his message. He was really an expert at that. And also his administration controlled access to him by the media better than any had before him. Clinton then went even further in sort of one of his advisors called the permanent campaign, that he always had the campaign sort of going on in terms of selling something, and had a lot of message control that they always said, you know, stayed on message. And of course, as we know from his scandals, he was definitely an expert at sort of parsing his language to say exactly what he wanted to, so that we would kind of get misleading impression about what was going on there.
You said too that President Clinton operated out of a war room within the White House, and that was something that was new for him. I mean, that was instituted with him.
That was new for a White House to set up really these actual war rooms for every major policy issue he dealt with, be it healthcare, welfare reform, even at his personal scandals. Of course, they had essentially a war room set up that all the people did in there was message control and work on selling that and marketing that policy to the public. That was really, I think, the beginning more than anything of outright treating promoting a policy to the public as a marketing challenge, the same way you would market a can of soda or a pair of sneakers.
Yeah, that's one thing that I had found interesting within the book, too, was just this talking about selling, say, a tax plan like you would sell a soft drink.
Yeah, it definitely is. You know, even Bush's chief of staff, Andrew Card, even famously said when it came to rolling out the case of the Iraq War that they didn't start doing it before Labor Day of 2002 because you don't roll out a new product before Labor Day, which is a marketing axiom that clearly they took to heart.
How do these public relations techniques become used? I mean, could you give us maybe some specific examples?
Sure. They're used because they can essentially game the media. They really exploit the weaknesses of our political media, which very rarely calls politicians on their dishonesty and is much more worried about being quote-unquote fair, which means going after each side 50-50, rather than calling somebody on their dishonesty. a good example I always like is in the Iraq War, both before and after, Bush was, as we all know, trying to connect Saddam Hussein to Al Qaeda, and he would tell us that there was an Al Qaeda offshoot group called Ansar al Islam that operated within Iraq. He said this numerous times, and so did Colin Powell and Dick Cheney, that there's this Al Qaeda group operating within Iraq, and the media would dutifully report it. And it wasn't false. There actually was this group operating within Iraq. But the catch was that it was an area of Iraq, northern Iraq, called Kurdistan, that has been outside of Saddam Hussein's control for over 10 years. So Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with them. They weren't under his control. It was the part of in the north where the Kurds live that was under UN protection. So he wasn't lying, but he clearly gave us a very misleading impression, which is really the way that these PR tactics operate. You don't technically lie, but you make people think something that isn't true.
Yeah, there seem to be a lot of examples of that in the book, and I guess the suggestion here is that even though politicians are routinely accused of lying, you're saying that the Bush White House hasn't really done that. They've been largely honest, but in a misleading way.
It's rare, and that's the thing. The media, when somebody outright lies, something that's easily disprovable, they usually get called on it. But that happens rarely, and often it deals with like personal scandals and stuff like that. People, the media jumps all over that. When things like this happen, that they didn't technically lie, the media doesn't really seem equipped or just hasn't figured out how to point it out and how to make people understand that the message they're getting is not the truth.
Yeah, that seems a real surprise to me. I mean, it's something that I'm not myself a journalist. This is something that I'm doing right now, just to kind of fill in for the regular host. But as somebody who is at least kind of peripheral to the media, I mean, I'm amazed that nobody within the media seems to be, or at least the mainstream media seems to be able to articulate some of the things that you point out here. Is it just the kind of the way that network news, at least, is put together? You've got to get everything done in 30 minutes?
Right. It's a bunch of things. It's really the ethos of the media right now is what we say in the book, is that one of the primary reasons is this allegiance to objectivity, which theoretically is fine, but the way we've interpreted objectivity is kind of this kind of he said, she said reporting, where, to take an extreme example, one politician can say 2 + 2 = 4, and the other one says 2 + 2 = 5. And by the rules of objective media, the reporter would say, today, candidate X said 2 + 2 = 4, and candidate Y said 2 + 2 = 5. And then you, as the reader or viewer, are supposed to figure out what's true.
Yeah, I saw a good example of this Monday, as a matter of fact, on CNN. They were doing a story about Dennis Hastert as the Speaker of the House and of course, part of or from Illinois. And he was doing making some remarks in which he made some statements about John Kerry, which seemed to be suggesting that Al-Qaeda would prefer that John Kerry be the winner in November.
Right.
And so they reported that, and then they did dutifully reported as well that John Edwards had come out and made some comments disputing that. Mm-hmm. And then at that point it just kind of passed away, and then you start seeing it along in the ticker at the bottom. Mm-hmm. The two statements just side by side, pretty much given equal weight at that point.
Right.
And really, even though Hastert's comments seem to be based upon nothing really other than Hastert's opinion, but not it certainly didn't seem to be anything substantial there.
You always wonder, what does a politician have to say? I mean, how baseless does an accusation or assertion have to be that the media won't report it? And I think, as we saw with the Swift Vote veterans, for instance, people can go really far and say pretty outrageous things that have no evidence, and they can get really far.
We're going to go to a listener who is on a cell phone. Car phone, you're on the air.
How you guys doing?
Hi. All very good.
Yeah, you referenced I'm just taking some of the examples there. You referenced some statements by George Bush about an Al-Qaeda group operating out of a portion of Iraq, mm-hmm, that was not necessarily under Saddam's control.
Yeah.
And do you know whether or not that group was allowed to move freely from that base in and to the portions of Iraq that were under his control? Do you know anything about that?
I don't remember offhand.
Does that mean you don't know anything about that? Because what you're inferring here is that because they're operating out of a portion that's not under his control, mm-hmm. you infer, at least to the listener, that perhaps they're not controlled or even abetted by Saddam Hussein, when in fact they were moving freely back and forth between the two regions. And let's not try to pretend that Saddam Hussein was against these al-Qaeda operatives, as if he had a spoken desire to destroy the United States. Very clear.
Yes, he did.
And so did al-Qaeda. And when this group is allowed to move freely back and forth, you, in fact, are doing exactly what you are accusing George Bush of doing by saying something that is technically true and allowing your listener to hear something, allowing your listener to be misguided. So, in fact, you're showing yourself to be exactly what you write about, and that's a shame, and it's too bad to hear you do that.
With all due respect, I'm calling. I mean, President Bush is the one who repeatedly, and his advisors repeatedly said that this was a group that was that operated in Iraq and had bases in Iraq, and clearly
yes, and they did.
No, they didn't. They had bases
in Iraq.
They were technically in Iraq, but as I said, they were clearly, and this was part of his making the case that Saddam Hussein had a strong connection. If President Bush just wanted to say this was a group that was headquartered outside of Iraq, but occasionally was allowed to come in or was allowed many times, that's fine, and he had evidence of that. That's great, you know, and nobody denies that Saddam Hussein disliked the United States, hated it, wanted us destroyed. There's a very fair case to be made for the Iraq War, and it seems like you're trying to make it. That's great. If that's not what President Bush often said, that's what we're pointing out.
What you just did is you misspoke or lied. He said that they were inside Iraq, and you're saying that they were outside of Iraq because you're claiming that the area was outside of Saddam's governorship.
Because I'm not saying that they were literally outside the borders of Iraq, but this was clearly, these statements were always made as part of Bush making the broader case that Saddam Hussein was supporting and had a strong connection to al-Qaeda. And the fact that they had a base and operated in a portion of Iraq not under Saddam Hussein's control is clearly as meaningless as if they were operating in Saudi Arabia or Iran or another country.
No, that's not true at all. Because if they're allowed to move freely from that portion of Iraq mm-hmm. that's under his control and the portion of Iraq that's not under his control, let's not assume that Saddam Hussein is hostile to that group.
If that was what President Bush was saying, then that would be fine. But that's not what he said.
No, we really need to keep this moving along. We've got some other callers backed up. So,
can I make one final point?
Yes, please.
That the 9/11 Commission mm-hmm. concluded that there was a linkage between Iraq and al-Qaeda, not between Iraq, Saddam Hussein, and the 9/11 event, but they concluded factually mm-hmm. that there was a linkage between Iraq and al-Qaeda, and that's my final point.
Thank you very much, caller. Would you like to follow up that?
I would just say that the 9/11 Commission did find that there were connections between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, and I don't think any reasonable person looking at the evidence would ever deny that. There certainly were connections. President Bush made a much stronger case that went beyond that evidence, however.
We've got a listener on Line 1 in Urbana. Line 1, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, in reference to the previous caller, the al-Qaeda people were in the Kurdish area of Iraq. They were no more free to move into the area that Saddam controlled than were Kurdish forces. They may have moved in secretively, but if they were caught, they were certainly executed on the spot. The connection to Saddam and al-Qaeda, as I recall in the report, was considered to be very tenuous. Am I right in that?
It was tenuous. I mean, obviously, that's open to interpretation. There was some connection, and I'm certainly not here to say, and because we're trying to be taken on partisan stance, I'm not here to say that was or was not enough of a connection to justify invasion. My point is simply President Bush often overstated that evidence and made it seem like there was a much tighter connection, and even tried to connect Saddam Hussein to the 9/11 attacks, of course. And that clearly is not what the evidence supports.
I certainly resent the previous caller's insinuation that you were lying. It seems to me you were being very fair.
Well, thank you.
And thank you.
Thank you for your call. Do want to remind folks the number to call here in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. Our toll-free line is 800-222-9455. And I do want to say that I don't want to get too sidetracked from the main topic, because I mean we could go on all day about whether this particular group was inside Iraq or outside Iraq, but we'd like to keep more or less on topic today, so just keep that in mind. But we've got a caller from Chicago on line two. Chicago, you're on the air.
Hello, but I think that this is the topic, because the topic is the fact that when people make charges that are not true, I feel that the other side aren't strong enough in their protest. For example, you need to point out that if there were any Al-Qaeda, they were in Kurdistan, which was being protected by the United States and Britain. And no one is bombing the United States or Britain, you know. I mean, we need to be really clear. And as far as the 9/11 Commission finding a relationship, they stated very clearly that Al-Qaeda contacted Saddam Hussein's regime, and Saddam Hussein's regime did not respond. Now, that is barely a connection. That's beyond even tenuous. So my problem with all of this is that when people make outrageous statements, like the gentleman saying that Al-Qaeda was moving back and forth, and you know very clearly that they were in Kurdistan, you know very clearly Kurdistan was under the protection of the United States and Britain, then that needs to be stated.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't help when people seem to, you know, Americans are so confused about geography, they barely grasp political information, that you need to be really clear and not let them continue on their befuddled manner.
And that's certainly what we try to do on whatever issue on our website and in our book, to say, look, here's what we know for sure. And sometimes there's some things we don't know for sure. We kind of say, look, here's what we know, here's what we're not sure about, here's what we know is false, and here's what the politicians are saying.
And you know, and Kurdistan was under the protection of the United States and Britain. So mm-hmm. in that case, someone else could make the charge that we were having a relationship with Al-Qaeda. I mean, it has just as much basis if you're going to use the fact that Al-Qaeda is able to move about in a territory and blame the people who run that territory for that. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that, you know, don't just say, well, I disagree with you. Explain very clearly why you disagree with them or why you think that this doesn't have merit, because people continue on with very befuddled concepts, and mm-hmm. I can only say it's because no one tries to explain anything very clearly and tell people, you know, no, it's not just that I disagree with you. I disagree with you because I know this and that fact.
Right. And that certainly is, as I have experienced doing these interviews, often harder to do on the radio or on TV, but I can promise you, go to our, I'll do my best here and on our website and in our book.
Well,
we make a very strong, clear, and simple case for what we're talking about.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you, caller. Our guest this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine is Ben Fritz. He is one of the authors of the website SpinSanity.com and of the recent book, All the President's Spin, George W. Bush, The Media and the Truth. I want to talk for a moment about the issue of objectivity, and this is something that I run into. My usual hat is program director for WYLL-TV.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, that's something I encounter as well, that there's a presumption by whomever, you know, watches us, if they are liberal or conservative, that there's always a presumption that if you express a view or have somebody on who says something you don't like, well, that's clear evidence that you're biased in one direction or the other.
Mm-hmm.
That's really something that's very difficult to prove that you're not biased. It's one of those, you know, when did you stop beating your wife kind
mm-hmm.
of questions.
Yeah.
But You say that, you know, this objectivity is it seems to be sort of a liability in a way, right? I mean, trying to be objective at all times. I mean, are you suggesting that it would be better to have an openly partisan press like they do in England?
Yeah, I think there are advantages to it. I think the, you know, objective media has done, you know, often does better at things like investigative journalism. There are things at which it's better. But there are things at which it's bad. And since we're talking about political dishonesty, I want to say it's bad at dealing with that issue. And in that sense, I think we would do better to have more partisan media. I don't want to say it should go all that way, But there are a lot of things we're missing out on by not having more partisan media. And what we really discovered in researching this book, drawing on sources, is it was often the more partisan outlets that did the best job at calling President Bush on his dishonesty or calling Democrats on their dishonesty in the other way. And sometimes I wish, you know, I think we'd be better off if we had more outlets saying, look, this is our perspective, where we come from the left or the middle or the right, and that's where, and that way you know where they're coming from, and that way they feel more free to criticize the other side, because often when they're trying to be objective, you're too afraid to point out when somebody's being dishonest because you're afraid that you'll be called, you know, biased.
Sure. We have another listener, and I believe it's line four. Line four, please.
Yeah, hi. I got into this fairly late, and I'm not sure how to enter the conversation exactly, but one of the first things I heard was your contributor there saying, it's like the Swift boat guys, obviously they're, you know, just, that was all lies or all da-da-da. I've read the book. Mm-hmm. 250 veterans, most of them who were on the water with John Kerry, signed up to that book, signed up to it as fact. It's footnoted extremely well. I think it's a very good contribution to the discussion. I think it clearly brings out some significant flaws in John Kerry's character, and I don't appreciate some guy, wherever he's coming from, your guest here, saying, oh, yeah, but that's obviously a pack of lies. I'd like to hear from him what's the lies in that book.
I obviously nobody knows for sure what happened then, but what I do know is that all of the paper evidence, all of the evidence beyond one guy arguing against another guy about what happened 35 years ago, doesn't support that the Swift boat veterans accusations. There's little to no paper evidence, and they have clearly engaged in some misleading statements. One thing I know for sure, they've gone after John Kerry for his Purple Heart, saying that he wasn't seriously wounded; it was only a little bit of shrapnel. When in fact, if you look at the military rules for getting a Purple Heart, it doesn't matter how serious the wound is; it's just whether or not it happened while you're in battle. So there's just sort of, I don't want to go into it forever on this interview, but there's one clear case where they've made an accusation that's just not honest and not fair.
At all. A Purple Heart at least requires hospitalization. All he required was Band-Aids. And two of them, by virtue of several people who witnessed it, were caused by himself. They were not in combat.
Well, that's
I think before you go making slurs like you did, you should at least, have you read the book?
I have.
Well, and you still say, oh, these 240 guys there who signed that, they're a pack of liars. And John Kerry, who wrote his own medal descriptions, he was the guy who authored them. He's the guy that's telling the truth here in those four.
Well, John Kerry clearly has plenty of veterans who see things from his side. So it's just a matter of one. I certainly don't know. I can't sit there and be like, this guy sounds more honest than the other guy. I can only look at the paper evidence and the rules for various medals, and that's the only thing I can weigh in on. And I know there's no paper evidence to back up the Swift boat veterans. And okay. And actually, the Purple Heart thing, it is simply a matter of being wounded in battle. It's not a matter of how serious your wound is. And in that case, a lot of their accusations just are not even based on the true rules.
Well, I just want to point out the slur you dropped, okay? And you trying to come across as someone who's critiquing the media, and you did just exactly what you're saying that you're critiquing them about. I just want to point that out, all right?
Well, thank you very much, caller. I think we do need to make sure that we don't get into personal attacks here. We welcome our guests and we welcome our listeners to call in, but just try to keep it on a non-personal level. One of the things that I wanted to address too was just kind of the role that now some of the non-traditional media are playing, and in terms of especially the late night shows,
yep.
the comedy shows, The Daily Show, Letterman, Leno, and such.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, another I think remarkable thing that we found was that The Daily Show often has done a better job of pointing out the way the Bush administration uses the PR tactics better than a lot of professional media outlets, than a lot of quote unquote real journalists. They love to point out when the Bush administration, when like eight different people will say the same exact words over and over in one day, which is clearly part of their message control. That's one of their favorite tactics, is if everybody says the same thing, that's all the media will have to quote, and therefore they'll have to quote their message, which is often misleading. And even David Letterman, if you look at his interview with John Kerry on Monday or the interviews he did with Al Gore in 2000, they're harder hitting, I think, than a lot of the interviews that are done on like network news or in newspapers. They really are more engaging and deal with the real issues and question whether they're being honest. And I think they just feel more free because nobody's going to say, "Oh, David Letterman's biased. He's not a real journalist." So they're often more free to deal with these issues of dishonesty than real journalists.
Well, you had said in the book, and I would agree with this, that one of the best interviews of George W. Bush back during the 2000 campaign was on the Letterman Show.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was a very well done interview. And you had mentioned, of course, the Daily Show showing the message of the day. And I mean, I remember, they do these kind of frequent montages of, here will be Condi Rice saying one thing and Dick Cheney saying the same thing, and all that. Why is it nobody else picks up on that?
There's a number of reasons. Again, one, they don't want to seem like they're going after anybody. Also, if you're like CNN, for instance, not to pick on them, you're covering the White House beat. If you really start aggressively going after the White House and upsetting them, then they might shut you out and not let you come to events or not give you the same information, and then you'll feel behind, not getting the right information, and you'll be quote unquote beat on stories, and that's unfortunate. But that's the way a lot of reporters work, and so they're often afraid, I think, to challenge their sources, and that's why it's often the reporters who don't have those inside sources and have to rely on outside sources that do a better job, because they're not so worried about pissing off the people in power.
Sure, sure. And certainly they've gone after both sides. I mean, right now they seem to favor the liberal side a bit, but my understanding is that's because the conservatives are the ones in power at the point.
That's certainly their argument. I don't know for sure. We'll see what happens if and when Democrats take power again. But, yeah, it's kind of hard to argue you should go after Democrats more when the Republicans are controlling the White House and both houses of Congress.
One of the examples that I saw of this kind of message of the day sort of thing was back when Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 came out. Mm-hmm. Just about everybody out on the talk show circuit or the Sunday morning news shows said virtually the same thing, which was, if asked if they were going to go see it, they said, "No, I'm going to go see Shrek 2 instead."
Yeah.
And it just kept getting repeated by several different people, and I thought it was just a very funny extreme example of that.
Yeah, well, my favorite example that we got in the book, we reprint some copies of some memos from Paul O'Neill, who was a former press secretary, the former Treasury secretary, that were used for the book that he put out, and it's a memo from his media advisor, and he's going on Meet the Press, and she tells him, first answer, no matter what the question is to say, we must act to ensure our economy recovers and people get back to work. So it's like, it doesn't matter what they ask you, it doesn't matter what the question is, you have to repeat our message.
Sure. We have a listener on line one in Savoy. Savoy, you're on the air.
I've been listening for about 20 minutes, so excuse me if I've missed something or if off point, but can you please, for the benefit of people who haven't been listening all the time, repeat who your guest is, and it sounds like he has written a book, and where he's from, if possible. And then, you may have covered this already, but since you're talking about truth and politics and involving the media, I'm not sure if you've already spoken about what has happened at CBS with Dan Rather and some behind-the-scenes contacts with the Kerry campaign in the form of Joe Lockhart.
Well, we haven't gotten into the CBS issue yet. As a reminder to everyone, our guest today is Ben Fritz. He writes for the website Spinsanity.com and was one of the authors of the book All the President's Spin. Would you like to speak toward the CBS controversy?
Sure. I don't actually have a ton to say at this point because there's not a lot for us to point out. I mean, this is clearly something people have gone after aggressively. Well, the one thing I'd point out is this shows, the advantages of sort of the independent media, which clearly a lot of online bloggers who first pointed out that these memos were worrisome and got people talking about it. And that's one of our arguments in the back of the book, is that, again, the sort of non-traditional media source like the Internet with bloggers, while it has its problems, can be really good at critiquing the media. And I think they clearly did a good job here of helping to get the discussion started about whether or not these memos were accurate.
One thing I was going to mention, too, just briefly, was the there was a story this morning from Michael Isikoff that was talking about the story that didn't run on 60 Minutes because it was pushed aside for this this other story about Bush's National Guard service. They were originally going to do a segment about how the U.S. government was, as they said here, snookered by forged documents purporting to show the Iraqi efforts to purchase uranium from Niger.
Yeah.
And now they feel that there's a little, it's a little ironic to try to report about this other, probably more serious story, because it's talking about how the government was fooled by forged documents, and now this is just totally pushed it aside, and that seemed to me an example of the kind of sensationalism you were talking about in the book.
Yeah, no, it's really a shame for a number of reasons. I mean, you would think that the U.S. government using deceptive evidence to get the nation into war, where over 1,000 Americans have died, would be more important than these questions about what President Bush may or may not have been doing 35 years ago. But that's not the choice CBS News made, and unfortunately that's a pretty typical choice for our national media to make.
Does the caller have any more comments?
I'm just surprised that you don't have anything more to say about the actual position that CBS took on this, and it's stonewalling, and Dan Rather's stonewalling, and I'm wondering...
Well, we usually weigh in on things again.
How might the public expect to maintain any credibility in CBS?
Well, I understand, and I myself would not go to CBS News first. Right now, it's understandable to not trust them right now. And the media is just like any other institution. When they prove that they're not trustworthy, they have to earn back their trust, This really exposed a lot of faults in the media. Hopefully, it will prompt them to do a better job in the future in terms of vetting these kind of documents, and also just kind of focusing on things that are more substantive and that you can more clearly know. There's so many. It's amazing to me. We focus on things like this, as we point out in the book, and you can see for yourself in all the president's spin. There's so many examples of clear dishonesty from our government in the run up to the Iraq War, for instance, or on tax cuts, or on science and the environment that the media ignored and were right in front of their faces. That for them to put all their efforts into documents that turn out to be false about what somebody did 35 years ago versus the choices we made 2 years ago is pretty astonishing and sad.
Thank you very much. We need to move on to another caller who's been waiting patiently on line 2 in Champaign. You're on the air.
Hi, Ben. I'd like to know, I have about 3 questions. The first is very easy. What is the, phone number for the GOP spin on things?
The phone number?
Yes, apparently people going into talks and so forth get the current spin on something.
Well, I don't know the phone number, but you can find it on the internet very easily at GOP.com or GeorgeWBush.com.
Okay.
It's all there.
Okay, I'd just like to thank you.
Sure.
And what is the likelihood that, in fact, Bush supporters fabricated this thing to catch Dan Rather?
I have no idea, so I don't want to speculate.
Because it seems
certainly
from the length of time between the advent of the disclosure and the fact that people were talking about whether fonts for a superscript TH existed at that time, within 4 hours, all the bloggers were, of course, unnamed or who knows who they were. It seems to me that there may be it may have been prepared.
There's certainly no way for me to know that. So
okay. What is the your take on the pullback of Seymour Hersh in changing in May of this year? A New Yorker article called "The Gray Zone."
Yeah,
you're familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
It talked about Donald Rumsfeld's okaying of Operation Copper Green.
Okay.
To do in Guantanamo and
Abu Ghraib.
Abu Ghraib. To get more eyes up Abu Ghraib, I guess. And
yeah.
And he, I think, is doing a disservice to our services by saying that the chain of command there might know about it. I mean, anybody who knows about it was probably viewing it from the bottom, because I think it went right from the Pentagon into the jails.
But again, this is a lot, there are a lot of these cases I don't.
Seymour Hersh seems to have pulled back on that. I've heard him on the radio, and he's now talking about how the administration knew about what was going on in Guantanamo in fall of 2002. And did nothing, quote, did nothing about it. Not that they okayed it. It's that, so that's, I think his article in this May was that the Rumsfeld had okayed it, but.
No, he's saying they did nothing about it. Yeah, again,
there's
I mean,
a difference.
He certainly should, if he's contradicting himself, you know, he should be admitting that and retracting anything he said before, but I'm not. Again, this is when these kind of cases of, like, investigative journalism where you need to know what's going on behind the scenes. Like, we're, I mean, I'm not. I only know what's sort of on the record, and that's the kind of stuff we point out as insanity, is things that anybody who has the time and energy to look up can find out to be true or false. I don't know at this point what the Bush administration knew or didn't know, or what Seymour Hersh's sources are.
Yeah, we are going to need to move along because we've got less than 5 minutes left, and I've got a couple of callers. So thank you, caller. We'll take one more. Please try to keep it short. Urbana, line 3.
Hi, Ben Fritz. I really appreciate this program, and I don't want the whole hour to go by without anyone actually plumbing your expertise. So
okay. For
the big picture, clearly everyone is running away from critical thinking these days, and being a big promoter of the skeptic movement myself, I think this has really come to a head. So what do we do? How do we get people to start taking responsibility for mistakes,
mm-hmm.
Thinking critically on every issue, no sacred cows,
mm-hmm.
and instead of getting righteous and indignant about political positions, actually admitting when people are wrong? When
right.
is this going to happen? Is there any chance?
Well, I think it's going to be a long-term project, and I think people are often so obsessed with, like, the current election and whether they want Kerry or Bush, and that matters, of course, it matters significantly, but we also need to think about the long-term issue of political dishonesty, and what we say in the book is it has to be about the media. Politicians are responding to the incentives they have. You can't expect any one politician to unilaterally disarm and stop spinning, because they're going to get their butt kicked, to be honest. The most important thing to do, I think, is either pressure the professional media to care more about this issue and or work on it yourself. I mean, Spinsanity is three guys in their spare time who do this, you know, and the Internet lets anybody do that. And I think for these kind of issues people care about, they need to work on making the media better so that politicians will know that if they say something dishonest or mislead the public, that they're going to get slammed for it and be criticized and embarrassed, and then they'll have incentives to stop doing it.
That's a great wish for the future. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, caller. That's a terrific question. We're running low on time, and before we go, I wanted to just quickly address, there's a statement near the end of your book that suggests that we've talked a lot about the Bush White House, mm-hmm. but, I mean, you're suggesting that perhaps if John Kerry were to take office next year, that things might not change that much.
Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of evidence that it will change dramatically. Kerry's engaged in more than his share of spinning in the current campaign because, as I said, he sort of needs to do it to compete with Bush. And there's plenty of liberal groups that are supporting him, like the Center for America's Future. Center for American Progress that doing plenty of spinning. Liberals clearly want to fight back. They want to fight fire with fire. And that's fine for their short-term goals, but in the long term, it hurts our democracy. So I think getting rid of George Bush is not going to solve this problem.
Well, it's very interesting, and of course, we'll keep an eye out for that, and of course, continue to check in on the website, spinsanity.com, for more information on spin one way or the other, one direction or the other. Our guest this hour on the Afternoon Magazine was Ben Fritz. He's one of the authors of the website, spinsanity.com, and the recent book, All the President's Spin, George W. Bush, The Media and the Truth. It's available now in paperback from Simon & Schuster. Thank you very much, Mr. Fritz, for being our guest today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm your guest host, David Teal. The executive producer for the Afternoon Magazine is Harriet Williamson. Our technical director is Henry Frayne. Next up is Todd Gleason with settlement prices from the Board of Trade.
Thanks, David. From the Board of Trade, futures finished the day like this in the wheat pit with a high of 329 in the nearby December contract, a low at 321.5. Their settlement price, 325 and a quarter. They were off a half cent for the day. March futures for the wheat, 339 the high, the low at 332 and a half. A settlement price at 336 and a half, down a half of the May contract, 343 and a quarter high, low at 338. Settled 340 and a quarter, down a penny and a quarter. July futures, 347 and a quarter the high, the low at 341. Settlement price there at 343 and a half. They were down a penny and a half for the day. From the corn pit, the nearby December contract, a 210 and a half high, a low at 207. A settlement price at 207 and three quarters. They were down 2.5 cents today. And by the way, in Champaign County today, the Post County price for the LDP is at 30 cents. And I spoke with Daryl Good this morning. He says that sounds like a good deal to him. So if you're interested, you might be watching that county price and the LDP across your region of the two-state area. And if it's attractive, it would be worth taking advantage of. March futures, 220 and a half, the high, the low at 217 and a half, a settlement price at 218 and a quarter, down 2 and a quarter. In the closing market report this afternoon, we'll go through how LDPs are figured. It takes about 2 minutes to talk about it, and I'm not sure that you'll actually understand it all by the time I get done, but we'll try to post it up on the website as a video once we get that produced from my office over in the basement of Mumford Hall here in University of Illinois Extension later this week, and maybe the video will have some CGs that'll help clear that up just a bit. May futures down 2 cents for the day in the corn pit, 227 and a half the high, the low at 224 and a quarter, settled at 225, down 2 cents for the day. In July, corn 233 and a quarter high, low at 230 and a quarter, settled 231, down 2 cents. September futures 239 the high, the low at 236 and three quarters, settled 236 and three quarters, a penny and three quarters lower. And December futures, 245, the high, the low at 243, a settlement price at 243 and three quarters. They were off one for the day. December oats at 169 for the high, the low at 162 and a half, settled at 164 and a half, a penny and a half lower. And the March contract, 172 and a half high, low at 168, settled 170, unchanged for the day. November beans, 543, the high, the low at 543 and three quarters, settled at 530, rather the low at 534 and one quarter, and a settlement price at 537 and three quarters, down a half cent for the day. January contract, 550 the high, low at 542 and a quarter, settled 545 and a half, three quarters of a cent lower. And the March soybeans, a 557 high, low at 550, settled 553 and a half, down a half cent. May futures, 564 the high, the low at 557 and a half. They settled at 560 and a quarter, down three quarters of a cent. July futures, 570, the high, the low at 563, settled 566 off a half cent for the day. Soybean meal, the October contract, 160.50, the high, the low at 158.20, settled 159.40, unchanged. And December bean meal, 162.70, high, low at 160.70, a settlement price there at 162.10. They were up 40 for the day. October bean oil, 21.97, the high, the low at 21.47, settlement price at 21.56, down 22. And December bean oil, 21.88, the high, the low at 21.40, settled 21.51, and they were off 20 for the day. Now in with the settlement prices from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange is Jay Pierce.
Thank you, Todd Gleason. And the September feeder cattle had a high price of $114.85 today, a low of $114.65. The settlement was $114.82.5, and that was up 12.5. October had a high today of $112.80, a low of $111.50. The settlement $112.65, up 20. November, a high today $111.75, the low $110.65, the settlement $111.45, up 15. October live cattle, high today $85.15, the low $84.15, the settlement $85.07.5, and that was up 22.5. And live cattle for December had a high today of $87.70, a low of $86.77.5, the settlement $87.47.5, down 12.5. October lean hogs, the high $76.15, the low $74.30, the settlement $76.15, up $2. December lean hogs, the high $71.25, the low $69.10, the settlement $71.20, up $177.5. February, the high $68.75, the low $67.02.5, the settlement $68.65, up a dollar even. And April lean hogs, the high $66.70, the low $65.20, the settlement $66.65, up $107.5. Frozen pork bellies for February. The high today, 103, 37 and a half. The low, 99, 80. Settlement, 103, 37 and a half, up $3. And that's a look at the Mercantile Exchange highs, lows, and settlements for today.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering Baltic bakery bread, caviar, and baklava. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting every Saturday. This station is funded in part by Illinois Issues, a University of Illinois at Springfield monthly magazine covering trends in Illinois politics and government. Complimentary issues are available by calling 217-206-6084.
You're listening to the Information Advantage WILL. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Todd Gleason in for Celeste Quinn. Coming up in the next half hour doing the closing market report, we'll talk with Dan Zwicker of AgriVisor Services out of Bloomington, Illinois, see what his latest take on the commodity markets, corn and soybeans, might be. We'll update how LDPs are figured. If you can't just quite figure out why the LDP doesn't make sense to you, well, we'll give it a shot and see whether we can give you the calculations. And if that doesn't work, you can visit our website at WILL.UIUC.edu. If my man over in Mumford Hall manages to get things done fairly quickly, at least today, probably for sure tomorrow, we'll have a video up that'll give a better explanation of how that process happens. That all coming up during the closing market report this afternoon and on our website at WILL.UIUC.edu.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Bob Campagna from Mount Vernon, Iowa, sends us this poser. Is there a way to get ocean tidal predictions for a given point on the coast?
You could check the World Wide Web, but I imagine you'd have a hard time separating the wheat from the chaff. After wading through every high school kid's homepage mention of the ocean, every link to the laundry detergent Tide, you'd still end up with something you couldn't rely on. No, if I were you, I'd check the Farmer's Almanac, or maybe the Magic 8-Ball. Or you could ask yourself a question before you fall asleep at night and see if you have a portentous dream. Any way at all would be more reliable than the web.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. For information about the new Dr. Science Get Smart Kit, including his new compact disc with screensaver for PCs and an honorary master's degree mouse pad, all for $21.95, call 800-989-9999. Duck, or visit us on the web at www.drscience.com.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Natural Gourmet, Champagne,